Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for tuning in, I should say. Leonard Pitts Jr. has been revered and detested by readers for years. He's a national columnist. You can read his work in the Miami Herald. He's a 2004 Pulitzer Prize winner, and he's written numerous novels and works of nonfiction. And he's worked in radio, too. He's challenged people from all walks of life, and he continues to challenge the problems of racism in our society. And he joins us now from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Mr. Pitts, it's a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it is my pleasure to be here.
I'm going to start with, you know, because to talk about, you know, some of the challenges that you've brought on to other people, you know, in your columns. And you're in a current spat, maybe, if that's what we call it, with Senator Marco Rubio. This started with a column that you wrote. I believe it's the one, "To Be Blunt, Shania, your comment backing Trump was really dumb." Remind us of Shania Twain's comments and what they illustrate about American politics.
She said that she voted for Trump, and I don't have her exact quote in front of me, but the part that really kind of set me off was that she said that because he seemed honest. And of all the things that Mr. Trump seems, I think it's objectively true that he does not seem honest. The column went from there, and it just sort of spoke about the fact that I've reached a point where I find it fruitless and counterproductive to try to have reasoned arguments and engagements with people who support President or support Mr. Trump, because frequently what they're identifying as facts are not in fact factual, and it's almost as if we're drawing, you know, one of us is drawing facts from what's going on in the world, and others are drawing facts from this alternate reality, and it's just a useless exercise. That's what seemed to set the senator off.
And she's, of course, Shania Twain is Canadian, so she wouldn't have voted in this election. But,
right.
You know, so the Senator Rubio responded in a tweet, and it went like this, quote, "This well-known national writer states very clearly that the 63 million Americans who voted for Trump are haters who should not be heard from or engaged in dialogue. It's a view widely held by many elites on the left, but very few of them so openly admit to it." Now, you came back with a column asking him, what does he stand for? Do you find yourself regularly in feuds with politicians?
I have never found myself in a feud with a politician, although I did get an upset phone call once from Jeb Bush, probably about 20 years ago. But other than that, politicians tend to ignore me, which is, you know, par for the course and as it should be. So I was a little bit surprised that he, one, engaged on Twitter, and then after that second column appeared, we had pretty much a night-long back and forth on Twitter, he and I, about his claims that Trump supporters sort of held their noses and voted for Mr. Trump despite his bigotry and misogyny. And the facts actually show otherwise, and I kept making that point to him.
What do you think about the fact that we now live in a world? I mean, look, a long time ago, you'd write a column about a politician, and they may go on TV and respond to it, but now, as you said, you can go all night with a politician or anybody on Twitter, and they're going to go back and forth with you. I mean, does that sort of conversation, is that good for political debate? Or, I mean, what do you think about the fact that you can do that now on social media?
I don't know that it's necessarily productive to be going back and forth with one another, particularly from his end as a public servant, to be going back and forth at one another in 280 character bytes. As one observer of the Twitter storm or tweet storm or whatever pointed out, aren't there things that he needs to be doing for his constituents? It just seemed kind of conspicuously, I don't know, bizarre, I guess, that he had time to essentially engage me in tweets for a night. The last tweet was from him. I found it in the morning after I had gone to bed. It was 12:14 in the morning, and it's, you know, it's like, okay, aren't there better things that we could be doing? I mean, maybe not me. All I was missing was, you know, some stuff I had on the DVR, but he's a United States senator, so you'd think that maybe there were more important things for him.
And then, of course, we look at, you know, after that, you did have another column again asking him. We still haven't answered me, Senator, but, you know, and we're going to reach out to him. We wanted him on the program as well, not just to ask about this, but a lot of other things. You know, one of the other columns, too, and because we talk about the president, we talk about his supporters, you challenge this idea of, trying to talk to Trump supporters. And I wanted to just, you know, ask you, I don't have a Trump supporter here, so I'm going to have to speak for them and say, look, not all of them are bigots, right? They're not all racist. They're not all bad people. I mean, I know people who voted for Trump. They're not that. Isn't it a mistake to not try to talk to people and see the differences and see where maybe we can meet eye to eye on stuff?
I'm an African-American man. I can't meet eye to eye with bigotry. And here's the thing. Here's the problem with the characterization that you give about, you know, the Trump supporter who is not a bigot. And it's the same question that I asked the senator that he could not or would not answer. What is the difference? What is the functional difference between being a bigot and voting for one? If I, as an African-American man, if you come approached me and said to me, Leonard, you know, I'm non-racist, I'm anti-racist, I'm with African-American people and all their aspirations for equal rights, but it's a 19, I believe it is 80, thereabout, I'm going to go vote for David Duke for the Louisiana governor. what weight do your claims of non-bigotry have with me?
Let me bring it to you this way. I think I've been thinking about this, and I think about some of my family members I know who voted for the president, and I know that they're not. But how about this? Is it possible that we live in a world where you're only part of Team Red or Team Blue, and you have no choice? You're part of the team. You have to vote for that team. There were people who didn't vote for Trump in the primaries. They didn't like him. But then once he became their candidate, they could never see themselves voting for the other side. Is it possible that we've just now live in a world where it's just blue and red, and you got to stick with your side, no matter what?
I understand why it's difficult to characterize the bulk of Trump supporters in the way that I have, especially for those who, unlike me, have family members and or friends or acquaintances who voted for Mr. Trump. It's kind of easy for me because I have none of that. But the facts are what the facts are. The studies that I've cited, and there's, I think I've seen three at this point, all point to the same thing. Initially, a lot of journalists, myself included, were saying that this was economic insecurity. But economic insecurity does not explain it all. In the first place, if it was economic insecurity, who's more economically insecure than African Americans and a lot of Latino Americans who would have been Mr. Trump's first voter? So that doesn't wash. Secondly, the researchers found that the people who voted for Trump, the people who voted most enthusiastically for Trump, his bigotry was not something they had to get over. It was the thing that attracted them. If all they had wanted was a return to Republican political policies, then they had their choice of Jeb Bush, Carly Fiorina, Senator Rubio. They had Lord knows they had lots of choices. But for some reason, they gravitated to, I'm talking about Republican primary voters, they gravitated to the voter, to the candidate who described Mexican immigrants as rapists and who had a history of federal housing discrimination lawsuits, and who said that a American judge of Mexican heritage was unfit to judge him, and on and on and on. We have to, before we can deal with or address or hope to resolve the problems that we have in this society, we have to have the courage to face what they are. And I think that where Trump is concerned and the reasons that people seem to have voted for Trump, a lot of us are refusing to do that.
Again, I'm talking with Leonard Pitts Jr. You can read his column in the Miami Herald. He is the 2004 Pulitzer Prize winner. He's also an author, and he's joining us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Where did your love of writing come from? When did it start for you?
It's funny because people often ask me, when did you decide to be a writer? And I never am able to answer the question because I never did decide to be a writer. I knew that I was a writer when I was 5 years of age. And, you know, I used to tell people that, and I'd see the shocked looks on their faces till I got older and had kids of my own and realized how young five is. But nevertheless, when I was a kid of five, I said that this was what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. And I wanted to, you know, my greatest hope was not to be like, I believe it's Salieri in the movie Amadeus, you know, to be, yeah, exactly, you know, to be okay at it, but not really good enough to make any kind of mark. I wanted to be a writer who was good enough that people would want to read them. So you know, that's probably outside of my family achievement. That's probably the proudest thing for me in my life. Just the fact that one, I was a writer, but two, that I was a writer that was able to, you know, make some kind of living at this for 42 years.
And when did you realize that writing editorials was that was your greatest strength?
I don't know that I ever realized it was my greatest strength. I started out trying to as a novelist. I wrote novels for many years and sent them to publishers, and publishers sent them back. So I spent a lot of years as a music critic, the last four of them for the Miami Herald, and then went on to do the column. So the column is sort of, you know, like the music criticism, it was a thing that I did because I wasn't at that point writing novels.
And you know what, if you've had a successful career as just writing novels, but you know, you've also, like I said, you won the Pulitzer Prize. Maybe that's why.
Yeah.
I thought that would be your greatest strength, but who am I? That's for me to, not me to judge, I should say. That's for you. What was it like, by the way, when you did get the Pulitzer? We've had a lot of different Pulitzer winners on, and I'm always fascinated by that question of, like, is this like the top of the top for you? Is that, you know, is that the biggest thing that you can get?
Oh yeah, professionally you don't do any better than to win the Pulitzer as a writer. It was an out of body experience that day. That's what it was like. And I also felt, because people had been predicting Pulitzers for me. People around the Herald newsroom, friends of mine, had been predicting the Pulitzer for so many years, since 92, and I was a finalist in, I think it was 93, but didn't get it. And I had really felt like I was letting them down every year when the list came out and my name wasn't on it. So one of the things that I felt, in addition to being, you know, happy and proud or whatever, was also relieved that I was no longer letting down my friends. Hey, I finally got it for us, guys.
You know, as a writer, what is the most important thing for you? What do you want to accomplish with your work? Are you just documenting life for future generations, or are you trying to ignite change?
It depends on the piece of work. I guess at the bottom line, whatever it is that you're, whatever work you're doing, the bottom line is that you're trying to communicate something. You're trying to communicate an idea. Certain columns, you're trying to change a mind. You're arguing a point. Certain columns are just primal scream columns. A number of my columns about Donald Trump have probably fallen into that category, where there's just a need to vent. Vent your head and frankly vent on behalf of a lot of other people. And there's observational columns, there's softer columns. I did a piece on looking at the moon, I guess it's about 3-4 weeks ago, for the Herald, which was a nice change of, it was a change of pace for the readers, but frankly it was also a nice change of pace for me to be able to just write about something that had nothing to do with race, culture, politics, gender identity, or any of the other touchstones of division that we have in this country.
But it, you know what? I'm glad that you brought that up. I do want to get to that, because that was a lovely article in that it was a change of pace. And I wanted to ask you about this project these two filmmakers were doing. But before that, though, you know, as a writer as well, you have to deal with hate from your readers, from your critics. Do you remember the first time you ever got a letter from a reader just wanting to rip you apart?
Not the first time. I remember some of the more memorable ones. But you know, that dates back to, you know, me saying mean things about Michael Bolton and Neil Diamond in the 90s for the Miami Herald, and probably even before that. So, you know, I get a lot of hate now, but you know, there's a certain special quality to the hate of an affronted Michael Bolton fan that, that you're going to find it hard to equal anywhere else.
I'm going to have to go back and find that, because I'm trying to figure out, well, I guess, what that hate could be for Michael Bolton. But anyway, I mean, look, one of the things that changed, obviously, is that people used to have to write a letter to a newspaper.
Right.
Now people are just tweeting you. They're waiting for you to tweet, and then they're just responding, and they're throwing the hate. One of the things that's interesting reading your Twitter feed is how you handle that. Is that something you learn over time, or is that just your natural way of dealing with critics?
I guess it's natural. I never thought it was anything special, but people keep telling me about my Twitter feed, and I'm going to have to go back and look and see what it is that I'm doing. But essentially, I give back what I perceive to be what I perceive the readers to be giving me. If it's something thoughtful, I'll try to be thoughtful in return. If it's something snarky and nasty, well, I've got that gear. I think I explained to somebody on Twitter once that. You know, I'm a black guy who grew up playing the dozens in South L.A. So if it's just going to be a game of insults, you know, you're gonna you you know, I'm pretty well armed for that. So let's not do that. Let's try to do something else. But if you want to do that, you know, here I am.
Have you ever come across somebody who commented and said something that just jolted you and you didn't even want to respond?
I suppose nothing specific comes to mind, but I'm sure that's happened. People have said, you know, people have said all sorts of things. It's reached a point now. I've been doing this column for 24 years now, that it's really difficult to surprise me. I seldom read something that I have not read before. I'm seldom called something that I have not been called before. But, you know, there's always that one that sort of jumps out at you. There's also always that one that's, you know, on the positive side. There was a reader some years back who told me about how he asked me a question, something about race that he thought was original and really incisive and would really sort of, you know, knock me on my heels. And I apparently got a very tired look on my face and answered the question for him because it was something that I'd answered many times before. And he said that he had been very disappointed, you know, by the answer. But then he thought about it and lived some. And 10 years later, it seen some things that it caused him to understand not only that I was right, but that the understanding that he'd had when he'd asked the question was entirely mistaken. So he thanked me for, one, being patient enough to answer his question, and two, for you know, sort of, I guess, enlightening him or whatever. And that, you know, that doesn't happen often, you know, very seldom, but when it does, it feels good.
You know, looking at your columns, your books, speeches mm-hmm. that you make across the country, again, the big issue you keep coming back to, you've talked about here today, is obviously the issue of race. It is a big, important mm-hmm. issue, and something that has really been brought more to the center stage in the last couple of years. But, you know, I know this is a big question, but what is your take on why there's this growing fear of brown and black people that's so virulent now in the 21st century? Why? Why haven't we grown past this?
Well, there's a number of reasons. First of all, I think that those of us who were beneficiaries of the civil rights movement really failed to keep our eyes on the prize, took our foot off the accelerator, whatever analogy that you want to use. But I think that we became happy, quote unquote, with progress and assumed that progress was permanent and forever. And I forget who said it. It might have been Thomas Jefferson. I may be wrong, but I love the quote, eternal vigilance is the price of liberty. And that's something that we are relearning. But I think that in a more immediate sense, what we are seeing in this country is an upheaval as a result of the fact that, as the Census Bureau keeps telling us, by the year 2040, this will no longer be a majority white country. It will no longer be a majority anybody country. All of us will be minorities. And I think that that sense of upheaval is what is leading to this sort of panic response on the part of some of those who have always enjoyed majority status and are you know, terrified at the idea that they are now going to be relegated to the minority. I think that's what a lot of the response to Barack Obama was about. A lot of the really over the top, overheated, disengaged from reality response to Barack Obama wasn't about anything that he said or did or was, except for. The fact that he was the first African-American president, and a lot of people looked at that and knew what time it was in terms of American demographics and became positively terrified.
This allows me to come back to this. I wanted to come back to this column you wrote recently about this film, because what I took from it was this, is that, you know what, even with all of these differences and all of our issues and problems, one simple thing could get us all to stop for a moment and just forget about it and think about something else. You talked about these two filmmakers, Wiley Overstreet and Alex Garoche, and they did this film with a telescope and challenging people to look up at the moon. Just briefly, what was that about? That was really interesting.
I don't know if you've seen the film. It was a really beautiful little film they did, about 3.5 minutes. They traveled around L.A. and they asked people to look in the telescope and look at the moon. And actually, they didn't even ask people; they were just there. And people come up to them and say, "What's that?" Because it's a telescope and it's an odd-looking thing for those of us who have no idea what a telescope actually looks like. It's a very odd-looking contraption, and people come up to them and want to look at it. And then everybody is amazed. Everybody says the same thing: "Oh my God! Oh my God! Oh my God!" At the closeness and the nearness of the moon. And it just, the point that I was making there is that sometimes we all, I include myself in that, we all get so entrapped in looking down into the detritus of our own lives, into the into the differences that exist between us, both real and superficial, into our own problems and the stuff that we deal with, that we forget sometimes to look up and to look out from ourselves. And I thought that movie was a great way of making that point in a non-preachy and maybe even non-obvious way.
Well, the column was lovely, but that definitely movie I'd like to check out, no question. I've been talking again with Leonard Pitts Jr., the 2004 Pulitzer Prize winner, author, columnist. He's done a little bit of everything, I think. He's joining us from the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C. Mr. Pitts, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for your time today.
Pleasure's all mine. Thank you.
All right, still to come on the program, climate change as a national security problem. That's up next here on Sundial on WLRN.